All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting on thelandofisrael.com, directly from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Out there, you are right now. If you're in your car, you're driving, and you're hearing this, if you're walking somewhere, you are right now in Jerusalem with me. Not only with me, but also with Rabbi Mike Foyer on Spiritual Cafe. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Yishai. It's great to be here.
And we are in Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, sulamyaakov.com, and we are learning Torah. And we need some Torah right now because the nation of Israel is under fire, maybe a tad depressed. It's not very Adar-ish out there in that just last night, a slew of attacks in Jerusalem, in Yafo, in the various capitals, wherever you think that is safe to be, it doesn't seem to be safe to be. The outbreak of jihad zombies continues out there, and it's like surreal. And even grotesque, we saw images yesterday of a Jewish man getting stabbed in the neck, pulling out the knife and stabbing the attacker to death. It's gruesome. It's almost whimsical in its gruesomeness. It's like, what is going on out here? You know, it's wild stuff. My wife Malka said to me this morning, you know, she manages a very big Facebook page with almost 400,000 people called Step Up for Israel, and she's like, what is an image I can do today to give people, you know, give people strength today? We got to give people strength, Israel strength. And I came up with my idea of, like, you know, I'm a big fan of that angel that Joshua sees and King David sees, you know, that angel with the sword drawn. Also Bilam sees him. But, you know, she said it wasn't exactly right. But the bottom line is we were looking for some kind of image. And the other image that I saw today, which really inspires me, is this is a little trite, but just seeing Jerusalem being built, just seeing people and children, very pregnant women. I saw a lady today who was carrying more than her load, more than her share should possibly carry. And yet the Jewish people are fruitful. They're multiplying and Torah is being learned. And that gave me hope. And yet there's no real channel for the anger and for the frustration that people are feeling, even with the Vice President of the United States in town. And maybe the terror show was for him. But indeed, that there's a palpable frustration out there in the air.
Yeah, and you said that the solution, or if not the solution, at least a reaction, is learning Torah. And I think that's because when chaos breaks out, it's also an opportunity to touch source. You know, that I feel that so much of what's happening around us is a response to the structures that we've built in the last 100 years, which have been amazing,
right,
but are starting to show themselves as inadequate to take us to the future. And one of the primary structures, to my great sorrow, that built this country was a rejection of the vision of the role of the Jewish people as the keystone to redemption, as it is written into the Torah. And here we are at the end of the book of Shemot, of Exodus, which is known in the rabbinic sense as Sefer HaGeulah, you know, the book of redemption. And so it's a tremendous opportunity right now, as things feel like they're cracking, to say, well, you know, when things crack, it's true they fall apart, but the mystics teach us that a seed has to rot in the ground before a tree can grow.
I work in Hebron. I'm the international spokesman of the Jewish community of Hebron, and I just got a very in-depth tour of the cemetery there,
mm-hmm.
The ancient Jewish cemetery.
No pun intended.
In that cemetery, there's a large area that was plowed over by the Jordanians. As is their custom, so too on the Mount of Olives. And there's pictures before and after, before 1948 and after. Before 1948, a large cemetery with a big marker for the 67 Jews who were murdered in the 1929 riots. Big, big cemetery. After 1948, plowed over, looks like a regular field. You just could not tell. However, in the eastern corner of that cemetery is an area where some of the great Torah scholars, the Reshit Chochma, the Chesed LeAvraham, there's others, great, great Talmidei Chachamim, some people say the Ramban, there are great Torah scholars that were buried there, and they were untouched. And this is the same thing that also happened with the Jordanians on the Mount of Olives. when the tractor got to the tomb of the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, it just flipped over, and again, until they decided not to touch the tomb of the Or HaChaim HaKadosh. There's something. Why do I say this? Because Torah, I don't think that Torah is the answer to violence. I think that there should be a state understanding that we should defend ourselves, we should fight back, we should destroy the jihad, and so on and so forth. There's a certain derech eretz, a certain simple reasonable logic that has to come before Torah. At the same time, the Torah is our anchor. And what I mean to say is the violence of the enemies would never touch the true Torah scholars, the true people who are connected to the higher spheres, to the real source of God.
Yeah, and what I meant by touching source is that in my mind, the Torah is the source code. Or, you know, in biological terms, it's the DNA.
And
so,
genome.
The genome. So we as the Jewish people in any given time in history are the phenome. We're the embodiment of that. And you know what happens when a particular embodiment faces an environment which is not conducive to its survival? It dies. But the process of evolution is the process of that genome constantly finding a form which is more fit to its environment. And I really believe that we live in a time right now, and it's not just us. I mean, look around us in the region. You look also in the United States, what's happening is the codes, legal, moral, spiritual codes, which have constructed the world in which we live, right? The forms which they've taken are starting to break down. And the question is, which ones will survive and thrive in this new environment, and which ones will go the way of the dodo, as they say,
right?
Right? And we as the Jewish people, living on the promise of the God, of God, you know, that here you go, here's the code. Your task is to keep living it. It's going to be tough. It'll be tough in Poland. It'll be tough in Spain. It'll be tough in North Africa.
Right.
But when you get home and you plant it here, it's going to grow into a tree which will never be uprooted. And the ground is fertile right now. We have that opportunity to touch that source and let ourselves take a new form which can redeem the world.
It's interesting you say about fertile ground. You know, what ground needs is upheaval. You literally have to upheave.
You have to turn it.
You have to turn it and then aerate it. And sometimes that itself is the process of growth. I think also that in a time of chaos, and I sense, at least from my kind of read on social media, which is a way to kind of touch the pulse
of the nation.
Of nation or and other peoples that are around you, there is definitely a sense of chaotic. There's something chaotic in the air right now.
Yeah.
In the American elections, which have an influence on the world, certainly here in Israel with these stabbings, something about Torah, which is eternally grounding, eternally giving you a kind of solace that in a chaotic world, the anchor of truth, the anchor of kind of stability, of stillness, is the Torah. Although the Torah itself is not still, it's vibrant and vibrating all the time. Still, though, when you take that time in your day to connect to Torah, you are kind of impervious, at least for that time and with that connection, to the vicissitudes of the world. Speaking of changes, we are about to exit out of the book of Shemot. Now, the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis, starts with the creation of the world, which is kind of beyond us, and therefore the Torah is laconic, doesn't use a lot of words about the creation of the world. It spares us a lot of commentary. And then the creation of mankind, and then the creation of a Jewish nation. That's the basic story. Now, the beginning of the book of Genesis is creation, and at the end, and there's going to be this like rise in the middle, and in the end, the Jewish people are going to be subjugated. They're going to go to the exile in Egypt. The opposite is the book of Shemot, the book of, you call it the book of Geulah, the book of Exodus. What's going to happen here is that we're going to first have Exodus, i.e. redemption. And then from this human and familial redemption, we're going to go back to creation. The end of the book is the end of the creation. It mirrors the opposite of the book of Genesis. The end of this book that we're in right now is, what is it, five Torah portions that are all dedicated to the creating of this Mishkan. One could even accuse the Torah, ostensibly, of being repetitive. It's so, the certain details are repeated, and they're being first conceived of, then explained, and then actually made, and then finally
put into place.
Put into place. It's like, if I was reading this book for the first time, I'd be like, whoever wrote this book really wants me to understand the issue of the temple.
Or they need an editor.
Or they need a
editor.
Editor, yeah. I would think that, but I would be, if I believed that it didn't need an editor, I would say, wow, God really, or whoever wrote this book, really wants me to know that a temple is important, and this is the mirror of the creation of the world.
Right. It's not just that it's important. There are two key lines, I think, that illuminate what you're saying. This idea that this is essentially the finishing of a new phase of creation. And they are, if you look at the end of the 39th chapter, right? After everything has been made, before it's all been quite put into service, it says, Vayar Moshe et kol ha-malacha, v'hine asu ota kasher tivar anai ken asu, v'yevarech otam Moshe. Moshe saw all of the work, and it's been done exactly as God commanded, and he blessed it. You know what the parallel is? Vayar Elohim ki tov ma'od. Right? God saw that what God had done was good. Right? That's what we saw back in the first story of creation. But don't forget, there was no evil then. The good there means that creation was a reflection of the divine intention. It was good in the, you know, aesthetic sense, like it was fit to the will of its maker. Here, Moshe says the same thing. He looks at the Mishkan and says, ah, this is exactly what God wanted, and then he blessed it. And then in case you missed it, only a few lines later, at the end of the next chapter, right, it says, Vayichal Moshe et ha-malacha, right? That he completed all malacha, which is exactly how Shabbat is introduced, right? Vayichal Elohim, right, et kol asher asah. God completed everything he did. So the question is, why? Why is the Mishkan, the tabernacle, a microcosm of creation? Because it essentially brings creation into its fulfillment, right? Because what did God want? This is the question that the whole world is dancing around, right? What like why? Why creation? The biggest question in creation is why. And this repetitive series, as you called it, is actually coming to drive home to us. Please don't miss it. Please don't miss it. This is why. Because God wants to be with us. He wants to be with us. And we don't have to get into the details right now of why each piece matters. And it does. Right,
but of course it does. I wanted to clarify that if anybody didn't understand that I was being facetious, or you know, kind of using humor, those things that I was saying were like as what you may have thought. Certainly, I believe and I know, and Jews throughout the world and throughout generations know that every word of the Torah is perfect and it's there to teach us something. And the whole Talmudic system, by the way, is based on the fact that we believe that every letter and every nuance and every word that may seem extraneous is coming to teach us something.
Yeah, but it's your facetious statement is giving voice to a real concern that people have. You know, when I teach Jewish law, I hear this question often. I'm sure we've mentioned it here before. People say to me, does God really care about that? Does God really care if I stick the milk spoon in the meat pot? Does God really care if I, you know, flip on a light switch on Shabbat? Whatever the question is. So I always have two answers for a student. First of all, would you want a relationship with a God that didn't care? Meaning, is there anything God doesn't care about? Really? The other thing, which if I have a good enough relationship, I often point out is, be honest, what you're saying is that you don't care. Meaning, when people say, does God really care about that? What they really mean is, well, how am I supposed to care about that? And then, do you want to live in a world where people don't care about what they do, where they believe their actions don't matter?
I think also there's an element of, I know better. I'm creating God in my image.
Yeah.
Meaning to say, God is subordinate to me and my understandings. And I understand better than him, and therefore I can psychoanalyze God. I don't think he should care about this at all.
Well, that's just in a more sophisticated way of saying, and I don't care about this particular thing.
Right.
And my point about this parallelism is that all the overwhelming detail, which culminates in this vaychal, right? There's a wholeness to it, right? Is begging and pleading with us, if you want God to dwell within you, then you must care about everything. Now, every piece has its place. Every people has its role. Every person has their task. We're not all the same, but they have to fit together in an amazing, harmony in order that the presence of God should dwell within. And that's how this book ends.
And the book indeed does end. The book of Shemot ends. It's also the Pesach book. You know, it's the book that's the book of Cecil B. DeMille. You know, it's the Ten Commandments. You got all that drama, and we're going to be transitioning to a very different book, the book of Leviticus, the book of Vayikra, which has here it's going to have if we've created the mechanism of the temple. Well, how does it actually work? What are the laws involved? It's called Leviticus, as in the laws of the Levites. There's also going to be a lot of social laws. And I'm thankful when, you know, when you're a kid, the book of Bereshit and the first part of the book of Shemot, of Genesis and Exodus, you can connect to the book of Leviticus. You're like, oh my God. As you get older, though, you really start to enjoy very much legally challenging and the blueprint Torah portions. I know I've enjoyed this year, especially with your help, Rabbi Mike Foyer, here in Spiritual Cafe, the blueprint parts of the Mishkan, of the Tabernacle.
I'm very excited for our exploration of holiness, because that's my understanding of what the entire book of Leviticus is about.
Let me break that down for people. Holiness. Does mankind possess the knowledge to make holiness happen? Does he have, and holiness is the prerequisite for, purity is the prerequisite for holiness, and do we know how to do that? And just very quickly, I'll have to illustrate my point here. I don't know if we discussed it here, but maybe we discussed it, but I was, did I ever tell you the story about myself? Did I talk about this last week about me being on the Hermon? I was in the army in the Hermon, on the white snowy mountain of Israel, the tallest mountain in Israel. Anyway, these I was in a closed military zone. Suddenly, this big truck comes up. This truck was a semi, like a really big truck, and out of the semi truck pop out six ultra orthodox Jews in black. Their blackness stood out on the white facade of the snowy mountain that I was at. And they came out with pitchforks. That's when I started getting nervous. You know, six ultra-Orthodox men jumping out of a truck in the middle of the Hermon in a closed military zone with pitchforks. One could get nervous. I didn't know if they were a new secret team.
I would remember if you told this story.
I thought maybe that they were a new secret unit to attack Hezbollah. But I didn't know what it was meant to do. And suddenly what they were doing is they didn't stop. The weirdness didn't stop there. They took out these big nylon bags, big ones, like a big one, construction bags, big construction things that the cranes lift, and they proceeded to take out box cutters and cut slits in the bottoms of these bags. It's like, okay, that's weird. And they were ruining these bags by cutting slits in them. And then they moved the bags close to snow, big snow piles. They climbed on top of snow piles and they pitchforked pieces of that snow into these bags. Then they had a little forklift. No joke. They had a little forklift, which came on the semi, and took these bags and stuck them onto what turned out to be a refrigerated. The truck was actually refrigerated. What is going on? It turns out that a mikveh in the north of Israel. This was exactly, the rains had stopped. There was still snow on the Mount Hermon. A mikveh had drained out in Metula. Somebody pressed the wrong button. All the mikveh, the rainwater left. And their only way to bring water in a state of purity, and not in a state of, because if you would use even a shovel to pick up the snow, it would be, why pitchforks, right?
Yeah, I was wondering that.
Why pitchforks? Because the pitchforks were only being used to break the snow so that it would fall almost naturally and never be carried in a vessel, which would disqualify it from being a good mikveh. And this whole crazy system of why the bags had these holes, so that, again, they wouldn't be a good vessel. It would be as though the snow had fallen. Now, listening to this, they transported this snow to the mikveh, dumped it in there. I wish I would have seen that part. And it became holy. It became water that was able to sanctify and purify and continue proper Jewish marriage and all that. That's a secret knowledge. You have to have the ability to know how to transport purity. You have to know how to create a mikveh. To me, that was the ultimate in the Jewish secrets, to know how to be able to bring purity and holiness, and that one shovel brand would disqualify it. Amazing.
And what makes it to me so uniquely Jewish, and how we differ from the nations of the world, it's all in the service of intimacy of relationship. As you pointed out, that the primary function of a mikveh in today's religious society is to permit a man and woman to be physically intimate together. And this is something that the nations of the world in general say, that's not holy. Right, that's something dirty. It's base. It's a concession to your physicality. And we'll discuss this when we get deeper into Leviticus, into Vayikra. We say, well, I just have to say it in the Jewish way, ifcha mistabra. Right, the exact opposite is true. The nature of holiness is an intimate grounding in the physical reality with which the Creator gifted us, And where, as we see at the end of the Book of Shemot, he so much longs to be together with us in intimacy.
So that is the to me, that was the story of the tabernacle. I understood that God was revealing secrets to us about how to bring him closer, how to be intimate with him. Okay, first thing, we got to shift gears now. I want to say two things. I want to thank our sponsors. First thing, our good friend Jack, who dedicates the show to Lillian, and to his sister Sarah, who we've met, are amazing people and are really part of the story, and can't wait to see them here in Israel soon, Bezrat Hashem. Man. And I want to thank you so much for helping us broadcast Spiritual Cafe. I want to thank the good folks at thelandofisrael.com, especially Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel, for making such an amazing network. And this network is going to be broadcasting more and more great stuff. I also want to thank a new sponsor, which is Capone Defense. We're going to talk about that in the next half an hour. Capone Defense will teach you everything you need to know about the Jewish and the Israeli way of shooting and defending oneself. So important today, but not only the physical act of defending oneself, but also the intellectual and spiritual component of what that means to be a Hebrew warrior in the modern age. That's CaponeDefense.com. And I also want to thank the good people of Chevron who let me do the show, and I work there as the international spokesman for the Jewish community of Chevron. And check out our website at Hebron.com. Absolutely a must. Check it out if you want to connect to the real roots of the biblical heroes. Of course, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their amazing wives, the mothers of the Jewish people, are buried there. I also want to thank Sulam Yaakov, sulamyaakov.com. Rabbi Mike Foyer, you're the educational director here, and you also have a brand new series on Esther, the Book of Esther, which
on the joy of the month of Adar and leading up to the holiday of Purim.
Okay, and people can check that out at sulamyaakov.com.
They sure can.
Absolutely. If you need more Rabbi Mike, then and you do, so go check out sulamyaakov.com. Now, let's shift gears into Purim. The fact is that I'm not going to be with you in any physical sense in the next 2 weeks. I'm going out to the United States of America. I'm going to be in New York and Washington for the APAC conference. I'm going to do some radio from there, hopefully, but we will not have the regular Spiritual Cafe for the next 2 weeks. I'll try to do some Spiritual Cafe wherever I am, but it won't be with Rabbi Mike until we come back, and I'm looking forward to saying Shehecheyanu when I get back here. Even without God's name in that case. But in any case, I want to tell you a little story about Godcast. Do you know what Godcast is?
Yes, I do.
Okay. If you go to YouTube, you can find these cute little cartoons on the Torah portion and other Jewish holidays called Godcast. It's G-D Cast. And sometimes it's cute and sometimes it's a little fluffy, but you know, I applaud the attempt to try to turn Torah into an entertaining thing so that people can connect to it one way or another. However, I must say that I was disappointed, shocked, and my eyes opened when I saw the Godcast rendition of Purim. Why is that? Because the whole story proceeds. Esther's the heroine. Everything proceeds throughout the whole story. You know, Esther's hidden, and Haman wants to destroy the Jewish people. And then at some point, Esther rises up because she's a proud Jewish woman, and she rises up and she says to the king, "Hey, king, this Haman is trying to kill our people, and we are a proud people. Please do something about this." And the story of Godcast ends that the king says, "No problem, I will take care of it." Meaning to say, they change the end. Everything is normal until the very end of the story. The part that Godcast deleted was that the Jews actually fought.
Yeah.
The Jews, the king, so the goy, he took care of it. The Gentile king. He took care of the problem. All we had to do was just say, "That's not right." We just wrote a letter to the editor. We made a rally. We said,
called our senator.
We called our senator. We said, "There's no moral equivalency." And we stood out there, Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza at the UN. and that was it. And it just got solved that way. There was no need for Jewish fighting and Jewish anger. It was just stand up for truth. I'm a Jew. I'm a proud Jew. I'm a proud New York Jew, and everything is going to be okay.
It's funny you say that because I've had a number of my students. I teach also at the Pardes Institute for Jewish Studies. Wonderful place. Deeply caring, committed, extremely liberal environment. And I've had a number of my students in the last few weeks approach me troubled by the end of the Megillah. And by the way, some of my former colleagues there are involved in the Godcast. It doesn't actually surprise me that that's the ending. Because, first of all, I've seen that there's a very low tolerance for messiness. Right? People have this idea that redemption should be clean, smooth. Right? As someone once said to me, but do you really think redemption is going to come through fighting? And my response was, have you ever read the Bible? Right? The Bible's a messy book. And we don't have to get into whether violence is glorifying and whether it's a good... I don't even have to get into that question. It's just actually real life. People live in a theoretical construct of redemption, and they want it to be smooth, number one. Number two, I think that the deep challenge of employing violence in order to change the world is that it can be evil or it can be good. Right, and the difference between the two, as far as I can tell, is actually the moral clarity that what you're committed to is God. And that's dangerous because, let's face it, there are people all around us right now who are very committed to what they believe to be God, are committing horrible acts of violence, and I don't think any of us would agree that redemption will come from there. But nevertheless, you can't avoid the reality of the end of that story, which is v'nahafochu. Right? It's the opposite. We did to our enemies what they sought to do to us. And by the way, what happens in response? All of the peoples around us see what? Our greatness. And many of them come over the side of Am Yisrael. And the irony, the really sad part of what you just said is that, but the reason that the Purim story is in many ways a failed redemption is because at the end we're still the slaves of Achashverosh. We're not able to push that process to its end. So in that movie, to say that Achashverosh solved the problem is actually to embrace the fact that we're the slaves of Achashverosh instead of free people.
It has a lot of responsibility to free people. And one of those, to be free people, one of those people that had tremendous amount of responsibility on his shoulders was Mordechai. Now, contrary to popular belief, the end of the Megillah says Mordechai is very popular. And that's actually there to tell you that he wasn't really so popular in the beginning. In fact, in a lot of ways, he was quite annoying, a dangerous zealot. Why are you endangering us by not bowing down? There are halachic leniencies that you can take in order to bow down to Haman. Please, you're bringing a holocaust upon us. You're endangering us with your capital T truth, and you're really not being reasonable. And you know, go with the flow. Why are you out? Don't be outside of the kehilah. Don't be outside of your poresh min etzibur. You're separating yourself from Jewish society. A lot of people didn't like him. And even the end, the Megillah says that he was. Oh. That's right. He was liked by the majority of his brothers. There were still people who were like, you know what? I don't think so. I never liked him.
They were still Jews.
And there's another aspect of that. You know, Mordechai. At that point, in the beginning point of the story, he was actually nothing like the rest of the Jews. He did not represent them. He was different than them. His spirit was different and more, I don't know, more radical, more intense, more zealous. But when Haman, I got confused between Haman and Mordechai. That happens sometimes.
That was a little early. That's right. It has to happen eventually.
When Haman encounters Mordechai, he says, I got to kill him and all of them. They are Am Mordechai. They are the people of Mordechai. And he senses within the Jewish people the possibility to be like that guy who right now does not represent them.
I mean, in a sense, every movement that has wanted to dominate the world has understood that in order to do so, it's had to destroy the Jewish people. And in particular, the movements that are universalist. I mean, the reality is at the beginning of the Megillah, when there are seven different advisors, all of whom are speaking to the king in different voices, and there's kind of conflict, so it doesn't really matter. The Jews are fine. They're just another voice in the harmony. It's only when Haman arises above them all and wants to concentrate powers in his hands so he can remake the world in his own image, that's when the Jews are absolutely necessary to destroy. Every universalist movement we have seen has needed to destroy the Jewish people. Listen, people don't like to call Nazism a universalist movement, but it absolutely was. It wanted the whole world to be in one way. Communism, the whole world to be in one way. Right now, Islamism, the whole world in one way. The church in its day when it was crusading, the whole world in one way. What unites them all? You have to get rid of the Jews. Today, even this humanism that masquerades as this great liberal force in the world is the Jews are a bone stuck in their throat. And in particular, like you're pointing out, the Jews that refuse to be like them. The ones that say, whoa, not so fast. We actually have a deep root in being particular and not universal, because our mission is universal redemption, which is about everyone being who they are and not everyone being the same.
That's a very powerful point. That is indeed a very powerful point about universal. It's so ironic. It's through that particularism, which is a kind of a realer, more a greater respect for the individual and for different nations and for different differences, that people can come together. It's when you try to erase those differences, they're not really coming together. They're actually destroying, and all those movements also destroyed people.
Yeah, there's a deep intolerance in all universalism, because as long as you're on the inside, then we tolerate you. But if you're not willing to be us, forget it. And people often accuse us, but what they miss is that we're particularists in the sense of we're the Jews and nobody else is. But we are universalists in the sense that you don't have to be a Jew to have a relationship to God.
But Jews are sometimes cantankerous also amongst themselves. And it was when Jews were kind of divided amongst themselves that Haman came to exploit that kind of weakness.
Absolutely.
And he says it. He said there's a divided people amongst you. And that meant to say that there's no kind of Jewish unity. One of the reasons that I'm flying to America and to APAC, and I have to remind myself of this, is not for issues. It's not for issues, and it's not for rights, and it's not for asserting our rights, and it's not for the dialogue, debate, and diatribes. What it's really for is to connect with brothers and sisters, and to unite those people. And I think Hebron also unites all the Jewish people, because that's where the Jewish family comes from. And not to not allow it to be divided, to not allow this great divide between North America and the mass of Jews there and the Jews of Israel, these two big poles, not to allow that rift to widen. And that was exactly the antithesis of the divided peoples in the Megillah. Megillat Esther is when Esther says, Lech Knoset Kot Kol Yehudim, gather all the Jews, unite them together. And that unity is not through a universal erasure of differences. It's through love. It's through uniting in those differences.
And you use the model. It's through family. I mean, if you think about it, we're the people of one, right? One God, one people, one land, 12 tribes.
12 tribes.
Right?
And many families.
Exactly. Because you're a parent. You know you have three children, right? I've got five. And the reality is love is one thing, but it's particular for each child, right? The goal, of course, is not to make the mistake of it being exclusive. But, you know, you wouldn't want an impartial judge in place of a loving father, right? That the idea that you're supposed to give the same thing to every child is a myth. You're supposed to give to every child exactly what they need. And in the same way, the 12 tribes represent the fact that we wouldn't want American Jewry to be just like Israeli Jewry, nor would I want the Haredim to be just like, you know, the secular world, or this one to be just like that. No, but we need to cultivate this sense that we're part of one family.
Okay, and on that positive note, in the background I hear a siren, and I'm praying immediately that it's not another attack. I'm hoping it's just another Jewish woman having a baby here in Yerushalayim. Say amen.
Amen.
All right, and the Jewish people are right now in a Purim-like fight. They're being called to fight for the right to exist. Wherever you are out there, I want you to get up and shout. Be part of that. Be part of Jewish strength. And that Jewish strength is, as we saw in the Megillah, is not just about returning to the ability to have Jewish strength and the ability to direct violence against those who are violence against us. It's also the return to Jewish culture, to Jewish Torah. And as we said, I think we mentioned it last week, that on Shavuot we may have been given the Torah, but on Purim we receive the Torah. Bezrat Hashem, we will receive the Torah. Rabbi Mike, I'm going to miss you for the next 2 weeks. Wish me lots of luck.
You should travel safe. I bless you that you should, at least in heart and soul, if not in body, bring home Am Israel.
All right. Thank you so much. Amen. And we will be back on Spiritual Cafe, getting ready. We'll try to remember what happened on Purim if we can, and we'll get ready for Pesach in 2 weeks. Till then, folks, be strong out there. Stay connected. Write me an email, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com, and any email to Rabbi Mike, I'll forward him immediately. Stay tuned, stay strong, and stay connected. And shalom.